Welcome to the Phi Life Podcast. I'm John Barber, and with me is Brad Pilon. And today we're going to pick up the discussion from last week where we left off about anabolic resistance, the anabolic continuum, and anabolic sensitivity. And I guess more specifically, we'll be talking about anabolic slowdown, which is what we think is really going on when your muscle gains and your strength gains plateau during a workout.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess we could talk about that. Sure. People are somewhat interested. So, I think it all really comes down to just the arguments over muscle growth, right? You just have so many camps of researchers who are, you know, you can grow, you can't grow. Protein makes a difference. Protein doesn't make a difference. You'll put on 8 pounds. You'll put on 3 pounds. You can build muscle and lose fat at the same time. You actually can't build muscle and lose fat at the same time. And it just gets really confusing, right? Like, how can all these people who are relatively smart, you know, in academic positions anyways, be so at odds over one topic? Right? It's a little mind-blowing. I mean, specifically when it comes into the effect of feeding on muscle growth, right? Like, it's probably when you start talking muscle building with anyone, you know, professional bodybuilder, complete novice, your parents, your cousin, the guy who works in a cubicle next to you, right? And inevitably, protein's going to come up. It's crazy because you look at the research findings and, you know, whether or not the consumption of protein drives the anabolic response. And you can get some papers say yes. You know, the Andrews paper from 2006, the Campbell paper from 95, you know, goes on and on. But then you get a whole group that says that, you know, it doesn't. There doesn't seem to be any relationship. In actual fact, resistance training can lower your need for protein. You know, you're looking at, like, the Hartman papers from 06 and, was it more?
Yeah.
Anyways.
And I find that was the most interesting one, looking through the research, that in some cases, or at least there's some data to suggest that by chronic strength training, you reduce your need for protein because your muscle's ability to assimilate it and use it increases.
Yeah. So, I mean, really, if we're looking for a causal relationship, which means that taking protein along with resistance training, the more protein you take, the bigger muscles you get. We just want a nice dose-response causal relationship between protein and muscle building. And it just doesn't appear always.
Yes. It sounds so simple. It sounds so simple to do. But
yeah.
Yet it's impossible to show, like, consistently.
So we're missing something, right?
Yeah.
And we can look to the evidence that if you take a large group of people, you know, not 10 subjects all the same age from the same university, but, I mean, large. And by large, I'm practically being sarcastic because in health and fitness type research, a large group is like 60 people, which is still pretty small in any other sort of form of human research. But you take a group of 60 people, you put them through a training program, and you measure the actual changes in the cross-sectional area of the muscle. And you can divide people up into basically non-responders, modest or moderate responders, and then just like extreme responders. And the difference in the cross-sectional area change in these people is striking. We're not talking people who got like plus 5 in the non-group and then like plus 15 in the moderate group and then plus 20 in extreme. We're talking like, you know, the non-group basically got zero change. The modest responders, you're looking at like an increase of maybe 1,000 square micrometers. And in the extreme people, you're looking at like a 2,500, right? So these are giant jumps. These are definite like...
And just to be clear, we're talking about people's responses to resistance training, like working
out resistance training,
with weight.
Yeah, exactly. So you take a group like that, you divide them up, and you're like, okay, these people definitely responded to resistance training, right? And this group over here definitely didn't, and there's these kind of guys in the middle. So you can divide them up like that. You're like, oh, simple. Let's just look backwards. You know, we had them do, you know, 4-day diet records, which I know are majorly flawed, but for some reason, we keep using them in the world of research.
But in this case, the problems with them will be consistent throughout all three groups.
Exactly. And, yeah, I mean, everybody tends to underreport on these, especially people who are trying to eat healthy. But underreporting isn't really an issue based on what we're doing. Anyway, so you divide people up, and you look at their reported protein intake. I mean, it's all right around the range that we talk about and how much protein. It's about 70 to 80 grams of protein a day.
Among all three groups.
Among all three groups.
So that means given the same amount of protein and the same workout,
yep.
Three groups of people will have three different responses to the workout.
Over 16 weeks of training.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so what we learn from that is that, let's just say, let's round it up, 75 grams of protein right in the middle, is either enough for the type of muscle growth that would be considered extreme, or it's also just the exact same amount you need for actual, like, close to zero muscle growth over 16 weeks of weight training. So obviously it's not rate limiting, right? Like, there's enough protein for the proper signaling and building blocks in one group, and enough for no response in the other group, right?
Well, you can't say obviously it's not rate limiting. Obviously it's not rate limiting in some people.
Yeah, in some people. Perfect. Exactly, that was what I was trying to get at, right? Is that in some people it's not rate limiting, in other people it still might be. I think the issue comes up again is that we're missing something. Is that the as our good friend Dr. Chung was explaining, the point of randomization is to control for compounders, right? Mm-hmm. To make sure kind of everybody's easy. But if it's difficult to randomize if you don't know everything about a group, especially when the group is small, right? So it just goes to point that something left,
well,
right,
I mean,
center.
Think about this. What if you studied enough of these people that you had a database of people who were responders and non-responders, who were moderate, non, and high responders?
Yeah.
Then you'd have to randomize for that too. But you don't know that. You'd have to do all this research just to figure out who's a responder or not.
Yeah.
So like the concept of randomizing people based on like height, age, and training experience, that's not enough. Like there's a lot of other things that go into. I mean, they don't even bother randomize. I mean, that still doesn't select out for things like height until you have like lots of people.
Yeah. So either way, I mean, the issue is here is that we're looking at protein intake and the anabolic continuum, and the bottom line is, you obviously just can't you just can't eat your way out of this problem, right? So regardless of research studies, regardless of research design, I think it's becoming abundantly clear that they all ate about the same amount of calories. The calories weren't massive. Interestingly, in this particular trial you and I are talking about, their body weights didn't overly change. You know, everybody was sort of dropped a little bit of fat, gained a little bit of muscle, cross-sectional areas increased, right? So the extreme growth people didn't eat their way to extreme growth. Something else is going on, right? Mm-hmm. And what I find really interesting is getting back to the anabolic continuum. Is it a really good way to figure out, a really good indicator of anabolic resistance is just a blunted response to feeding, right? Or looking at it in the opposite direction, a really good indicator of anabolic sensitivity is a heightened anabolic response to feeding, right? Because maybe the resistant group isn't blunted. It's all relative what you're comparing it to. But the point is, there may be a sweet spot, a period of time, a specific point in your training life where you can eat your way big.
Right? Or influence it with things like protein and amino acids and maybe, I'm still skeptical about calories, but maybe protein and amino acids.
Yeah, exactly. And the interesting thing there is then, is there...
How do you find it?
Well, not only that, but interperson variability, right? So maybe different people, depending on the training programs, depending on the genetics, get there faster. Maybe some people stay there longer, right? So you and me are on the same program, but for some reason, based on genetics or muscular innervation or satellite cell availability, right, you hit that sweet spot 3 months before I do. And you, for some reason, are able to stay in there 4 months longer than I can, right? Well, then you've grown more than I probably ever will,
mm-hmm.
right? So this whole process, and it doesn't mean that you've stopped growing. It just means that there's
your rate of growth is probably diminished.
Yeah, well, and none of that. But we know there are. It'd be safe to say. Let me slow down here. That muscle growth is multifactorial, right?
Mm-hmm.
We don't just have B happens, muscles grow. Right. There's so many things going on. There's work-induced growth. There's juvenile growth. We know that there's a combination of nutrients, hormonal responses, and just mechanical responses. So just saying, okay, during that sweet spot, you know, that's the one time you're going to grow. It may, in fact, be wrong. The idea of the anabolic continuum may simply be based on the continuum is dependent on the way we currently understand how to organize our training. Right, so that whole idea of anabolic sensitivity, you may in fact be able to grow even during periods of the end period of anabolic slowdown. You just have to use much different methods than you would have during that period where you're highly anabolic responsive, during that high anabolic sensitivity period, right? So maybe during that sensitivity period, maybe it's, and again, theoretically, we're just throwing out numbers here. Maybe it's 2 to 3 years into your training, of consistent training, all of a sudden you hit that sweet spot where, yes, protein makes you grow, and you know, the traditional style of training makes you grow. When you start falling out of this process, you know, perhaps just simply we have to abandon those previous notions of how to set up training, and we can't just sit there and keep thinking back to how we used to be able to grow and trying to recreate that over and over. You know, maybe the entire physiology of how your muscle responds has changed. Right? But bottom line is that there is an anabolic continuum. Right? There is a period of anabolic resistance in the beginning, and then, you know, and heightened anabolic sensitivity, and then it kind of all goes downhill from there. I mean, we just can't deny that. It's obvious. So I think from a sort of a phylife point of view is that instead of just pretending this continuum doesn't exist, which is what everybody's doing, right? It's just pretending that we're all going to grow at exactly the same rate for our entire lives, and if you stop growing, it's just because you're not pushing hard enough in the gym kind of thing, right? Mm-hmm. And realize that there's more at play than simply what you're doing in the gym and how much protein you're eating. Much more at play. And in fact, looking at how multifactorial muscle growth is, it could be things you're doing in the gym that are actually preventing you from growing muscle. It could be, that could actually be pushing you into periods of anabolic slowdown where you're not growing the way you used to. So I think the whole point of it is just that this concept that all people are going to hit periods of anabolic sensitivity at different times, at different rates, and for different lengths of time, may help explain our confusion as to, like, you know, does protein have a dose-response relationship with muscle building? Now the answer can be, well, it completely depends on your where you are in the training life cycle, right? Resistance training, volume sets, reps, rest, no rest again would depend on your training age as opposed to like your chronological age, right? Like obviously chronological age is going to play a part in this as well, but training age may be something that's been just ignored in the fitness industry for a great period of time that might help explain some of these sort of black box thinking we have going on about what makes a muscle grow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then from there it's, I guess what we're trying to move towards is fitting your, what we know about you, so your training age, your chronological age, maybe the style of training, the way you've organized your training, and then overlaying, you know, taking that information and using the concept of the anabolic continuum to figure out where you are and try to figure out maybe how to squeeze some more growth out of your body, looking at it from that standpoint instead of kind of the old school way of thinking.
Yeah. And, you know, I really like sort of popped in my head, and I'm, again, just as a caveat to this, by no means just because all of a sudden things pop in their head are we claiming that we discovered and or created any of these terms or theories. It's just that this is when we figured them out, which may have been years after someone else figured it out. Have no clue. But I like the concept of training age, because when you think about it, I mean, just looking at where you and I are now compared to, like, first, second, third year university, obviously there's a massive difference in training age and just your ability to adapt to training stresses, your even just almost, I want to say the innervation of the muscle, but I just remember, like, let's say back in like third, fourth year university, if you got stuck under a weight, and we'll just use bench press as an example, everybody gets it, you could just push, right? You know, your training partner goes for it, and you're like, no, I got it. And you might sit there caught right at that kind of that sticky spot for like 5-6 seconds before either you maybe get it up or he pulls it off of you, right? And that's sort of really specific to that training age, because I can tell you right now that if if I got stuck in that same spot, there would not be 6 seconds of struggling with it. It would have been, oh dear God, my shoulder. Please someone pull this off of me. Like you don't have that ability just to sit there relentlessly pushing against a non-moving weight, right? Like it may not be a muscle tendon ligament thing as much as it's a mind thing, right? Because once you've had an injury, right, they hurt, right? So your brain's pretty wired to be like, okay, we're not going there again. So things like that come to training age, just recovery, et cetera. And it can be all confounded by the fact that, like, when we all think back to the glory days of training back in your university or college, I mean, you could just sleep whenever you wanted. You didn't have to really go to class, that kind of thing, right? Like, you had the capacity to sort of fit your life around your training schedule. We don't all have that luxury anymore. But training age in itself is something that's generally ignored. And so the truth is, and something I keep going back to, is that there may be, and I know this is very, very counter current fitness culture, there may be a logical explanation for why every 19 to 23 year old that you see in the gym is guzzling back protein drinks and talking about how awesome NO Explode is and, you know, just loving up the supplements, while, you know, everybody younger than them is like, I didn't get anything out of it. And everybody older than them is like, dudes, you're wasting your money. But for that small group and their specific training age and the where they are in the anabolic continuum, I don't know. It might be having an effect. Right?
I mean, it could. Based on everything we're seeing there in the research and what we see people doing, it could. We can't say it is.
Yeah, exactly.
But I guess what we could say is we can't say it is, but we also can't say it for sure isn't.
No. What I'm saying is it would be worth exploring whether or not the anabolic continuum can explain away some of these areas where we seem to have a cross of research where, you know, you can take a giant cross-section and look at it and go like, wow, there's definitely, when you get a large enough population, no effect.
And the
right?
thing
but
is,
then when you look at small groups, you're like, oh, but in this small group, there is an effect. But when you pull it all together, it goes away, so it must not mean anything, right? But
and the problem is you can never run the perfect study to show this because it would require a crossover design of living your life twice.
Which I can't believe that we haven't figured out how to do that yet.
Yeah, like how come – yeah. But because basically you'd need to go through the last 10 years of training using supplements, using protein, using everything, and then relive it all and not use it and see which one produced a better result, which you're never going to – I mean obviously
or
you can't do that.
Or an actual way to classify – identify and classify what's changing during the anabolic continuum, what parts of muscle physiology – I mean we're getting to the point where we're – I guess what we're saying is to properly identify subjects for a study, you're looking at genetic testing of what's going on in the muscle.
Yeah, like, okay, so to actually have accurate data on how a muscle-building program or a muscle-building supplement or a muscle-building program that involves supplementation, dieting, protein content measured, all that stuff, to know if any of that stuff is doing anything, you need to first determine what the anabolic sensitivity of the person is or where they are in the anabolic continuum.
Group them by that.
Then test protocols on people who are in anabolic resistance, anabolic exhaustion, anabolic slowdown, anabolic high anabolic sensitivity. If you group people that way, then in those groups, feed some of them protein, feed some of them creatine, feed some of them protein plus, you know, protein plus creatine, amino acids, high and low calories. When you look at it that way, then this is what we're proposing. Maybe you get a way better or way more accurate view of what works and what doesn't work instead of what we think is happening now is you have a mixed group of people, some who are highly anabolic sensitive and someone who are in full bore anabolic exhaustion or resistance. And then you give them all protein. And of course you're going to get three different results. And then you end up with like equivocal results that sort of don't mean anything.
Yeah. So we're getting to the point where we'd want to like, you know, do some sort of index of that. I'm just throwing it out there, like satellite cell count, something random like that. Right. That where you're like, oh, okay. Yeah. We're dividing you guys up based on this. But, I mean, I think the main thing is, and the other problem we're going to run into then, is that from what I can tell from what you and I have been exploring with the concept of the anabolic continuum, is that the continuum itself and how you use it, abuse it, may then affect the continuum. As just an example, one of the possible theories of this anabolic slowdown and sort of the muscle's lack of response to training could be to do with chronic inflammation, low-grade inflammation in the muscle, which could be due to chronic weight training, so it just all gets very muddled, right? I think we can agree, though, that based on this concept, there isn't really a logical reason why someone who's, you know, their training age is advanced should train like a beginner or someone who's in that training age, is that sort of sweet spot of high anabolic sensitivity, right? I just don't think as an experienced lifter you should be training like a beginner, or you should be training like, I don't know, whatever you'd want to call that in your prime. Is you have to change up your training, and I think you have to change it up drastically. I think we're not talking a little bit of, oh, well, I used to do higher volume when I was young and now I do low volume. I just don't think it's that easy. I think we really need to explore. Obviously, you can't change the rules of building muscle. We're just looking at ways of different ways of implementing them.
Or rearranging them.
Rearranging them, yeah. So
you still got to lift weights. They still have to be heavy. You still have to do some kind of volume. You still have to take some kind of rest.
Yeah.
But it may look...
You have to progress.
Yeah, well, it's like writing a different song. It's gonna be really different. It's not gonna be the typical one you're used to.
Yeah, but in the end, it'll still be a song, right?
it's still a song, but it's just not gonna sound at all like what you're used to.
Yeah. Right, so, again, now we get to the point where obviously, you just can't design, and I know that our friends who are PhDs necessarily are gonna love it when we say this, but you just can't design a one weight training program for everyone. Right, it doesn't work. It has to be very specific to the person's needs, whether it's, you know, I want to look better, I want to perform better, but now it's also the training program has to be designed based on where they are in a continuum. Mm-hmm. Because some training program built for beginners to help them put on 40 pounds of muscle, it's obviously, I don't know why you'd be using that same program if you're intermediate or advanced in terms of your training age. Not even your training experience, but your training age. Because I think that training experience, you know, I could say I've been training for 17 years, but really it's been on and off, and I take big giant chunks months off at a time. Whereas I think you could really accelerate your training age. It's like I've only been training for 5 years, but I was a D1 athlete down in the States, and I was training for 4 years, like, you know, twice a day, sometimes 5 days a week. Obviously, your training age is accelerated compared to your buddies who just sort of hit the gym 3 times a week to train arms.
Which I don't. There's two theories on that. It may make a difference, or it may not make a difference. The total number of reps.
Yep, totally.
So let's say if you just can fit, like, let's say one guy fit in 100,000 reps in a certain number of years on one particular body part. And another guy, it took him twice as many years, but he still completed the 100,000 reps.
Oh, yeah.
What, are they both? Do they both end up at the same spot? Right. Like the amount of time you spent doing it probably changes that, but maybe not that much.
And then it's a training age muscle specific. We know muscle growth is muscle specific, right?
So it's
muscle specific. It's
right. Yeah.
It's basically what we're trying to say is that, and we've said it again and again and again, but the actual study of muscle growth is young. Right, and we've tried to jump at it and sort of just jump right into it and try to figure out what's going on, and there's just a lot of unanswered questions. And a reminder that, like, too, like, really, what's a long term weight training study?
16 weeks, maybe.
I mean, I'm sure
tracking people for maybe a year, but you can't.
A year would be good.
Yeah, but that's just tracking them. You can't be right on top of them, forcing them to do stuff all year, and then actually know how well they complied with the workout. Like. Yeah. I don't know of too many where they're with a trainer that often.
Yeah, and then when you get people who have been, like, you know, super consistent for 5-10 years, in fact, it's part of their lifestyle and or how they make a living, the rest of the lifestyle that goes around being that type of person, how do you control for that?
You can't. You have to look at the whole life.
Yeah. So the bottom line. So, yeah, our understanding of the anabolic continuum is limited by the fact that it's very difficult to do long-term studies on training, and then, the type of training you do, you know, obviously the people you can sort of assume did long-term training are athletes, but not necessarily gym rats. And I know it's sort of not the nice term for it, but you know what I mean? Like, it's so a 4-year professional Olympic javelin thrower, for instance, right? You can be like, well, this guy trained with weights consistently for the last 4 or 5 years, and like, it's different. It's different style of training, right? With different purposes and goals, and the guy who's just in the gym trying to get "quote unquote" jacked, right? So we just don't have the data. Just I guess to be more accurate, I just haven't seen the data, right?
Yeah, well, I think it's safe to say we're not really sure.
Yeah. Beauty. So okay. So the point of this all is that I think that the anabolic continuum is a very overlooked thing. If not overlooked in science, at least overlooked in the fitness and nutrition industry. It's something that never shows up in supplement ads. It never shows up in fitness magazines. It's going to start showing up over the net, but it's going to be because it's going to be written by Brad Pillon and John Barbin. But other than that, it's not something you can just sort of find information on. It's a new concept, and of course, it's highly theoretical. But it has to be something you have to consider in your training. Is it, if it, since the anabolic continuum makes a lot of sense, then why would you, as an a very experienced lifter, lift like a beginner or someone in their prime, and same, right? Why would someone they're beginning ever train like an experienced lifter, and would they get the most benefit from doing it? The questions we have to sort of look at and answer. And it's not just as simple as, because I know everybody's going to be like, oh yeah, it's less volume as you get older. I doubt it, right? It's probably more volume and more rest somehow. Is mm-hmm. it, as completely impossible as that sounds, that's probably where we're going, right? Is it just a matter of the population satellite cells? Is it a low-grade inflammation? Is it the something dampening the mTOR pathway? Is it focal adhesion kinase? Don't know, right? All we know is that most of the markers that we measure acutely would suggest that every time you train or eat protein, you're getting bigger. But whenever we measure long-term, it doesn't pan out. Yeah, something's happening there. Yeah, we need to work.
Like right now with the available data and the available ways to measure things, which is very limited. I don't think people realize how limited we are with our ability to measure this sort of stuff. The picture, it's like having a puzzle and all the pieces are just sitting on the table and you don't have the picture. You don't have the cover of the puzzle box. So all you have are just the puzzle pieces and you have no idea how they fit together or what it's supposed to look like at the end. Yeah. And that's kind of where the research is at. Like, you know what? And we're probably missing some pieces right now too. So, eventually we'll get there. And you're trying to build the puzzle in the dark. Like that's kind of about where we're at, trying to figure out how this works.
Yeah.
So the pieces are there. We just don't have really no idea how they fit together yet.
No. Yeah. And so bottom line is that really we don't have an answer for what the mechanism is. But we do have the obviousness that your training has to change. Right. If you're not in a period of where everybody else has been studied, which is typically when they're just starting to train or in that sort of that prime period of training, if you're not there, there has to be a radical change in how we approach training.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be the sort of putting it all together of this talk, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
Yep. And
I think we're good. You got anything else?
Chicago and Philadelphia are tied 3-3 going into overtime for the Stanley Cup Final. So I think that maybe we get the overtime period.
Word. All right.
All right. So, ladies and gentlemen, that's it.
All right. So for Brad Pillon, I'm John Barbin, and that's your final.
No, wait. Hold on.
What?
Who's winning?
Who's winning what?
Chicago, Philadelphia, going overtime tied.
Who's going to win?
Yeah.
Oh, Philly.
All right. I'll say Chicago. All right. Let's do this.
All right.
All right. Out.
Talk to you next week.
Yeah.